The dignitaries on this day had their place in the historic moment. And they were those people who came here to pay respects, as we have said, from 84 nations, and maybe more will be represented by dignitaries by tomorrow. Of course, the chief of all of them, by protocol, is President Charles de Gaulle of France. He is chief by protocol for the simple reason that he is the only chief of state and head of government so far to arrive here. The President of the United States is chief of state and head of government. France and the Fifth Republic is the only nation in the world that has a major nation that has a chief of state who is also head of the government and by protocol is equal to the President of the United States. President Charles de Gaulle arrived late today. He was greeted by Secretary of State Dean Rusk at International Airport. That's one of the four airports that are receiving dignitaries, and taken immediately to the French embassy. He has stated before that he felt it absolutely necessary that he be here in his own personal presence to represent the people of France. And as he walked through the airport after shaking hands with those necessary to greet him, he spoke to his associates. Allons, allons, he said, three or four times. Let's go. And they went to the French embassy. Also on hand already are Prime Minister Ikeda of Japan and Eamon de Valera of Ireland, the president of a nation who is in his 81st or 82nd year. He's almost totally blind. And then came West German Chancellor Earhart, accompanied by his foreign and defense ministers. And there's Britain's Prince Philip, who represents Queen Elizabeth of England, who cannot come because she is near the time of a child, a third child. And there's Russia's first deputy premier, Anastas Mikoyan, representing Premier Khrushchev. Well, he will arrive early tomorrow morning. Premier Khrushchev has insisted that Russia should be represented. He did this as a mark of respect not only to the American people, he said, but because President Kennedy is a realist for peace, and he admired this man. Incidentally, Prince Philip was not only greeted by our Secretary of State, Dean Rusk, but as a measure of respect, all of the ambassadors of the Commonwealth Nations of Britain were on hand to greet him when he arrived. And, of course, there was an extremely busy day in Washington for the President of the United States, Lyndon Baines Johnson. President Johnson is conducting his business from his home in Spring Valley, a home he acquired from Pearl Mesta, a Washington hostess, 2 years ago. The Secret Service are there, the only mark that it differs from any other home in this rather plush area near Washington. The president conducted business all day because he felt that some things had to go on, some things of great importance. Perhaps he even thought that we should know that the business of the government, our continuing government, was being handled. The first official act of the president in his first full day in the office of chief executive was to reaffirm the policy objectives of John Kennedy in South Vietnam, where there's trouble with the Viet Cong communists. President Johnson received Henry Cabot Lodge, Jr., the ambassador to Vietnam, who had previously been summoned to Washington by President Kennedy. A rather quaint note here in protocol and deference. Ambassador Lodge had stopped in San Francisco, and he was resting there before having his appointment on this Sunday with President Kennedy when he heard of the death of his chief executive. Ambassador Lodge immediately announced that he would proceed to Washington to report to the Secretary of State that it would be presumptive on his part, presumptuous, to make a report to a president who had not asked for one. Today, President Johnson, despite all of the pressing duties around him, asked for that report to stress the continuity of our policies in Southeast Asia. And the White House disclosed that every policy heretofore followed in South Vietnam will be continued. There was a full-scale review of the new government and its fight against the Viet Cong in Vietnam. There was also a decision that our forces in that part of the world will be withdrawn as soon as possible, and the schedule for withdrawal already set by President Kennedy will be carried forward under President Johnson. And the announcement was made by Pierre Salinger, President Kennedy's news secretary. And he noted that the president would leave up to the intelligence of the officials involved how long they wished to serve him there. Incidentally, it's already been noted that President Johnson asked all ambassadors and all cabinet officers to continue to serve. Dignitaries, business in Washington. Incidentally, permission was given today for the national banks to close. It is assumed that savings and loan institutions will close, along with state banks all over the world, for the final requiem mass for John Fitzgerald Kennedy tomorrow. Inevitably, at this point, we must go by contrast. It draws us like a magnet, the scene in Dallas of the second tragedy. It was about 10 o'clock today, apparently, that this scene began to unfold. The part of it that we tell you now was not known to the public or to anyone. When it began, it was a moment when a nightclub operator in Dallas, Texas, got into his automobile and drove from that club four blocks to the Dallas City Jail. In the jail was, of course, Lee Oswald, the suspected killer of President Kennedy. Jack Ruby, the nightclub operator, parked his automobile across the street from the basement of the jail and walked rather hastily across the street. And then he leaped over a 3-foot barrier and dashed, before anybody could do anything about it, dashed into the basement of the jail. Inside, reporters, policemen, guards were waiting for the transfer of Lee Oswald from the jail to an armored car to be taken for safekeeping into the county jail of Dallas County. No one could have known what would happen next, but it so happened that the world saw it. The whole world saw what happened next, the murder of Lee Oswald. Here is that scene.
There is the prisoner.
Yeah, there is Lee Oswald. He's been shot. He's been shot. Lee Oswald has been shot. There's the man with a gun. It's absolute panic. Absolute panic here in the basement of Dallas Police Headquarters. Detectives have their guns drawn. Oswald has been shot. There is no question about it. Oswald has been shot. Pandemonium has broken loose here in the basement of Dallas Police Headquarters. Now, whether the bullet literally hit Oswald or not, we are not absolutely positive, but there has been a gunshot. Oswald reached for his stomach, doubled up. It'll be impossible to determine whether he was hit or not. Did you see whether or not he was hit? He was hit, wasn't he?
He grabbed himself on the side and fell to the ground.
That was my understanding.
Cry.
We were, what, 4 feet away from him?
I was 5 feet in front of him when they shot.
What is your name?
Frank Johnson.
And you're with?
UPI.
He did grab his stomach. I saw him grab his stomach.
Right from the side.
And there you have heard the greatest piece of television and radio journalism since the beginning of this medium, nearly 30 years ago. The reporter, Tom Pettit of NBC News, who alone reported exactly and all of what happened there. But naturally, at the moment this shooting occurred, Tom Pettit could not organize his thoughts. You have absorbed what he absorbed as fast as he absorbed it. Since then, of course, he's had time to organize his thoughts. And as tired as he is, we've asked him to do it and to tell us in an organized way what happened this morning just after 11 o'clock. To Tom Pettit, NBC News in Dallas.
Here's what had happened in the basement of the Dallas Police Department. Just as Oswald was about to walk the 20 yards or so to an armored car, which was to carry him to the Dallas County Jail, a man identified almost immediately as Jack Ruby walked out of a group of reporters, quickly across the roadway, up to Oswald, and fired at point-blank range into his lower abdomen. Just before that moment, a police officer had shouted, we are told now, Jack USOB. As Oswald, mortally wounded, was retrieved inside the building to await an ambulance, another officer subdued Ruby, and he was immediately put into jail. One officer, handcuffed to Oswald, we are told now, tried to jerk him out of the way of the .38 snub-nosed revolver, but did not succeed. Oswald died at the hospital. Ruby is held in jail. Tonight, District Attorney Wade said he had seen Ruby at the police station Friday night as Oswald was taken down a corridor the night after President Kennedy's assassination. Tom Pettit, NBC News in Fort Worth, Dallas.
Lee Oswald was taken with a wound just below the rib cage, a dark and purple wound that did not bleed. He was taken to Parkland Memorial Hospital, exactly the same hospital where President Kennedy was taken the day before, and he was wheeled to the opposite side of the corridor, about 10 or 15 feet from where President Kennedy had laid the day before. And there, 12 physicians in relays worked over him, but they discovered exactly what they had discovered in the case of President Kennedy. There was no hope of saving his life. In his case, it was different in that President Kennedy had been shot in the brain and in the neck, and massive damage had been done to brain tissue, the kind of brain tissue that motivates respiration and heart. And, of course, there was no way to save him. He died in 20 minutes. But today, Lee Oswald lasted nearly 2 hours. But there was massive damage to his liver, to one of his kidneys, to many blood vessels in his abdomen, and the doctors knew from the moment they began an operation that there was no hope for his life. All day long in Dallas, the police continued to insist that they had plenty of evidence that Lee Harvey Oswald had been the killer of the President of the United States. There were definite bits of evidence that traced the rifle he had bought, a rifle manufactured in Italy, a 6.5 Italian carbine, that had been traced from Italy to a mail-order house in the United States, from the mail-order house to the post office lockbox maintained by Oswald in Dallas. It had been traced to his home, and yet there were slight gaps. The police said that they had closed the case, and District Attorney Henry Wade earlier today had announced in Dallas that the case was now moot against Oswald, meaning that, in a sense, it had been finished. There was no point in carrying it any further, and he would not reveal, he said earlier today, all of the testimony he had and evidence he had. He did say, the district attorney did say, that the evidence was conclusive. In Washington, immediately, there was shocked surprise that anything like that would happen, that any such evidence would be concealed publicly. And so later, in Dallas, the district attorney of Dallas County changed his mind. I think he has begun to recognize that he is inevitably a part of a tremendous historical fact, however distasteful that fact may be. And he acted quickly tonight to change his idea of the record of this story and what shall be done with it. And for that story, we take you to Robin McNeil in Dallas.
Dallas police, who refused today to say anything more about the evidence against Lee Oswald, tonight changed their tune. Stung by reports that the Justice Department was dissatisfied with the investigation, Dallas District Attorney Henry Wade called a press conference and went through the evidence piece by piece. What he said was in every detail what has been published, except for one main fact. Wade said Oswald bought the murder rifle, took it Friday morning to Dallas, was in the window of the building overlooking the route. The new detail was that Oswald's palm print was on the rifle as well as on a box in the window. Contrary to earlier statements, Wade said the case is not closed, although he personally has no doubt that Oswald killed President Kennedy. Robert McNeil, NBC News in Fort Worth, Dallas.
The decision to reveal all of the evidence in the case against Lee Oswald has relieved some of the tension in Washington. Our high officials there have been worried about the reaction in other nations, among other governments, as to the tragic and violent events in the United States in the last few days. Other nations have a tendency to think of us as a rather reckless nation, even though many of them have shown instabilities far greater than ours. But nevertheless, we are the leading world power today, and anything that happens here causes reverberations, reactions, and in this case, those reactions and reverberations are not at all favorable to the image of the United States, either in the free world or the communist world. Therefore, you can understand when our officials in Washington reacted as they did when the Dallas authorities said at first they were not going to release the evidence against Oswald. They cried out in their private hearts that this not be so, because this is making a mystery, this is creating suspicions. Hence, there was reaction in Washington. And for that reaction, we go now to Sander Van Oker in Washington.
Dallas District Attorney Henry Wade said today he would not divulge any more of the evidence local officers have against Oswald. Said Wade, the Oswald case is moot now, and we have to get on with the Ruby case. The Justice Department says the Oswald case, so far as the federal government is concerned, is not closed. Katzenbach told me tonight the Justice Department will continue its investigation of Oswald and the events surrounding the president's death. Officials concede the evidence is very strong that Oswald was the president's assassin, and the evidence, they'll add privately, comes pretty much from the FBI. But there's no disposition here tonight to let the Dallas police or the Dallas District Attorney say without challenge that the Oswald case is closed because he is dead. They tell you with some bitterness it is not up to local officials to say this is the end to the investigation of the murder of a president. An attempt will be made to gain federal jurisdiction of the Oswald case, and there are many ways to do it. The purpose of this is so that when all the leads have been run down, and this may take a long time, then the evidence in the Oswald case can be made public. Though it is not a federal crime to kill a president, the Justice Department takes the attitude it has the duty to fully investigate the case and make its findings public. These are the facts as a reporter must report them. But a reporter must also report an attitude and a state of mind. And tonight it must be said that some officials in this government find the events too complicated in Dallas and too puzzling to leave any longer to the competence of Dallas authorities. While they concede that the case against Oswald was a strong one, they also ask, were there others involved? Did he do this of his own volition, or was he put up to it? And they want to know what a nightclub owner with a police record was doing inside the basement while Oswald was being moved. It's true that anyone who knows anything about American cities knows that police are familiar, perhaps too familiar, with nightclub owners. But officials here wonder if that was any reason for allowing Ruby to slip in with reporters. Did they, ask, someone want Oswald killed so he could not talk? They continue to ask these questions as they seek to gain federal jurisdiction of the Oswald case. They have a lot of theories. Some, they will admit, seem far out. But then, as one official said to me tonight, what is more far out than the murder of the President of the United States? This is Sander Van Oker, NBC News, Washington.
It was exactly that reaction in Washington, conveyed to the Dallas authorities, that produced a complete revelation of all the evidence in the hands of the Texas authorities. And now we have it that they will release anything else they get as they get it or soon thereafter, and all of it will be in the hands of the federal authorities of the United States government in time to come. And I can report on my own two facts that have not yet been reported. One is that the federal authorities have not, definitely have not discovered any connection between Lee Oswald and any subversive organization or any other government in the world. They have conveyed this to other governments to be sure that others understand that whatever suspicion attaches to this man attaches in a way that is not direct, but every investigative agency of our government for some time to come will investigate, as Mr. Van Oker has told you, every possible lead to be sure that their conclusion at this time is final, that when the history books are written, 2 years from now, 10 years from now, 100 years from now, every possible fact concerning the assassination of President Kennedy will be before the people of the world. This is a free nation, and the concealment of facts of this kind in itself would be tantamount, ultimately tantamount, to crime. Twice on this second day after the assassination, twice, men of keen minds have referred to the violent death of President Kennedy and his accused killer. They've referred to it publicly in a way that seems to speak for all Americans, or at least the thoughts that all Americans should have at this time. In Washington Cathedral, the Episcopal Reverend Francis B. Thayer, Jr., in his sermon today, said, "The weapon that killed John Kennedy was not only in the hand of the murderer, but was in the heart of every one of us who ever hated, who ever set brother against brother in his selfish spirit. Blame not," he said, "the man, nor the city, nor the region where the deed was done. But let us search our own hearts to see if pettiness or hostility set the stage for the overt act that occurred 2 days ago." And today, in the echoing rotunda of the Capitol, Chief Justice Earl Warren said this over the bier of the slain president: "What moved some misguided wretch to do this horrible deed may never be known to us. But we do know that such acts are commonly stimulated by forces of hatred and malevolence, such as today are eating their way into the bloodstream of American life. What a price we pay for this fanaticism." It has been said, he went on, that the only thing we learn from history is that we do not learn. But surely we can learn if we have the will to do so. Does ever a criminal, sane or insane, know how far the rippling damage of his violence reaches? That is a question I put to you. How deep into the lives of millions of people? He does not know. I, a news reporter, put that question to you. Part of the answer to that question comes from NBC's correspondent in far-off Anchorage, Alaska. An Eskimo man stumbled out of the cold of the night. It was 12 degrees below zero. Stumbled into a cafe. He had traveled far. As he warmed himself in the cafe, he kept repeating, "He was a great man. He was a great man. He was a great man, and somebody had to put a slug into him." The Eskimo turned and asked the aproned waiter in the cafe what time Mass would be said. He found out, and the Eskimo explained, "I have stayed awake all night. I have traveled far. I want to go to Mass. He deserves at least that much from me." And when the time came, a few minutes later, he stumbled out to church. Part of the answer. And now, before I give you another part of that answer, I report that this is Morgan Beatty in Radio Central, New York. Perhaps the most spontaneous answer occurred in Fifth Avenue in New York, a few hours after a rifle bullet traveled 75 yards from a warehouse into the brain of President Kennedy on Friday. On that day, it was dusk in the first traumatic day. People drifted by ones and twos and threes into St. Patrick's Cathedral on Fifth Avenue until one worshiper, unknown to another, they had formed a congregation of perhaps 2,500 persons. They prayed and sat in silence, one among them without a word, without a sign from any other one, went to the organ in that great church. He began to play, and just about on the second or the third note, every voice in that church came into life, spontaneously came into song.
Amen. ABC Radio will begin coverage of the events to take place tomorrow, Monday, November 25th, at 7 a.m. Eastern Standard Time. This coverage will be continuous and will include the final Requiem Mass at St. Matthew's Cathedral in Washington, D.C., the funeral procession, and the burial of the late president in Arlington Cemetery. Tonight, immediately following a pause for station identification, NBC will present a half-hour interlude with Alexander Scourby and the musical work, The Testament of Freedom. We now pause 10 seconds for station identification.
WWJ and WWJ-FM, Detroit. From the WWJ newsroom, here is a summary of late happenings, Don Perry reporting.
WWJ News has learned tonight that Jack Rubenstein, alias Jack Ruby, the man who shot and killed Lee Harvey Oswald today, has a brother living in the Detroit area. It is understood that Ruby's brother is en route to Chicago to pick up his sister and then go on to Dallas. The brother's Detroit area home is under police guard, inside and out, we understand, at the request of his wife. Reporters were barred from the home by officers tonight. Mayor Jerome P. Kavanaugh has proclaimed Monday a day of mourning in Detroit. A memorial service for President Kennedy will be held at the old City Hall site downtown at noon. Federal Judge Wade McCree, Jr. will preside over the services. Mayor Kavanaugh and Council President Ed Carey will participate.